Chapter 33. Once again, the light of Jakku presses hard against Sloane's eyes as she and Brenton are ushered forth by Nora Wexley and that mad droid. When her eyes adjust anew, the first thing she sees in the sky is her ship, the Ravager. Sloane has a pang deep inside, like a string being plucked, the resultant vibration humming in her marrow. Regret courses through her like a poison. A choice presents itself now. She could run or overpower Nora in order to steal a ship. She could take that ship up to the Ravager. She could land and regain control. Not an easy task, no, but she is confident in her ability to get it done. Then she could take her ship and just go. It would not be an act of cowardice. It would be one of survival. The Ravager is a superstar destroyer, a dreadnought of mighty proportions. It is by itself a massive flying city. It has enough room to contain a powerful remnant of the Empire. It has the weapons to hold off a whole fleet, as it is doing right now by pushing back the New Republic Armada. She could take the Ravager. She could spare some portion of the Empire and flee into the stars with that massive vessel. With it, she could start over again. The Empire could start over again. But that would mean setting her vengeance aside. And that is something she just cannot do. The urge for revenge is like a hook in her cheek, and it's drawing her miserably toward it. Tug, tug, tug. Rax has ruined it all. He has touched the Empire with a filthy hand, and foul streaks of his treachery are everywhere, corroding all that she loves. The Empire to Sloane was an entity of order and discipline. It was about upholding stability in a chaotic galaxy. It was about vanquishing uncertainty and providing a way of things, a schematic, a backbone, a path for all to follow if they wanted to be safe. And now, it's this, a wild, brutal remnant, like a broken spear stuck in the sand. The troopers have turned to common thugs. The officers are haunted and overwhelmed. This is a primitive place, and it has made them primitive in return. The Empire that she loved is gone. That revelation reaches her again. And this time, for the last time. In her heart, she lets the Ravager go. Just as she let Adia Wright go. And just as she is letting all the hopes for the Empire's future go. Nora's blaster prods her in the back.
You want to keep moving? We don't have time for sightseeing, Admiral.
Just Sloane, she says. I'm an admiral no more. Just a rebel like you. She keeps moving toward the shuttle. And toward her vengeance. Akbar's chair swivels from station to station as he examines the battle map. His massive, gelatinous eyes flick their gaze among screens, assessing the situation. And the assessment is not ideal. This should have been easier. The New Republic fleet is larger. The Empire has been waning. On paper, it's an easy victory. And yet, so far, it has been anything but. They've already lost a contingent of corvettes. Two frigates are down. Countless starfighters have been lost to the swarm of TIEs that fill the void. Of course, Admiral Akbar is a student of history, and in many cases, smaller, lesser forces have outmatched and outfoxed their betters. The Ghostfinder fleet versus the Sith Armada, the Mandalorians versus the Grand Army of the Republic, and of course, the Rebel Alliance versus the Empire. History is rife with examples of weaker forces routing the stronger, and that may happen here, too. If they're not smart and cautious. The Empire has changed their tactics. They are fighting with a brutality and a chaos that has never been seen in their repertoire. One frigate broke in half when a single TIE bomber crashed head-on into the bridge connecting the two halves of the ship. They expend their weapons in every direction. Their attacks offer no rhyme or reason. The old Imperial maneuvers, always so neatly predictable and textbook, either are being willfully ignored or have simply been forgotten. That lends their defense a desperate, dangerous edge. It is quite honestly hard to combat. It's also, Akbar supposes, exactly what made his own fleet so difficult to fight his rebels. The other component is that damnable dreadnought. It has 10 times the weapons loadouts of a single Star Destroyer. Its shadow is deeper and wider than the dark of space beyond it. The other smaller destroyers circle it, parting long enough to allow torpedoes and turbolasers to lance out in the divide, injuring the New Republic fleet while protecting it. It's like a hive protecting its queen.
But if we kill the queen, the hive will die.
Right now, 3 of the best and brightest ships in their fleet are surging against the Imperial fleet in order to take down that dreadnought. The Unity, the Amity, and the Concord. Those 3 Starhawks, with their blunt hatchet fronts, are meant to drive a wedge in the Empire's cordon of Star Destroyers. But they're simply not breaking through. They're tangling with the destroyers while taking fire from the Ravager, taking all of the brunt while earning little of the advantage. He thinks to engage with Augate to discuss a new strategy, but that will have to wait, as the hologram of General Tyban appears. Tyban is a narrow-shouldered man. His head is square and bald as a cube of ice, and he's near as pale, too. His features are knotted with worry.
Status report?
Akbar asks.
Ground forces are finding some success, Admiral.
Tyban answers. The hologram flickers, not uncommon given the chaos of battle. So many frequencies and energy sources to interrupt the transmission.
We have pushed their line back, click by click. We may be advancing on their base by nightfall. That is, if we can stem our casualties. We're hemorrhaging lives. The Empire is fighting less like the Empire and more like an insurgent force, Admiral. They take risks. They sacrifice their soldiers. It's pandemonium. But they seem to be using it to their advantage and not their detriment.
We are experiencing similar up here,
Akbar growls.
But we are not so fortunate as you. We have gained little ground. Keep pushing forward. If you find success on the ground, it may earn us an edge here.
Tyban nods and hesitates before saying,
I should be there.
You are best on Chandrilla, kept at a distance.
And he is. Akbar told the Chancellor to keep one of their best military strategists in reserve, safe with her. He warned her to be wary that Jakku could be a ruse. The Empire tempts them to attack, thus leaving both Chandrilla and Nakadiya vulnerable to predation once more. That meant dividing their forces and keeping security high in the New Republic worlds. Still, that seems to have been a false concern. There's been no sign of any threat as yet.
You have your men on the ground, led by Lieutenant General Brockway.
But with me present,
we have no time for this, General Tyban. I thank you for your concern and your update.
Akbar ends the holographic transmission, then turns to open a channel to Augate. But his webbed hand pauses, held fixed over the console as he gazes out the viewport of the Home One bridge. His blood goes cold as saline as he watches the tragedy unfold. One of the Star Destroyers, the Punishment, turns its nose drastically starboard. It turns right toward the Starhawk Amity. And the Amity has little room to maneuver given its proximity both to Augate's Concord and to the battle raging all around it.
It's suicide,
Akbar thinks. He believes it must be an accident, but it seems to be deliberate. The Punishment's nose is like a sweeping blade,
and it crashes into the blunt fore of the Amity, shearing through it. Fire blooms in space. Bodies drift. And the punishment keeps going. Thrusters burn at the back, and repulsors fire along the side. The destroyer becomes a weapon as it cuts the Starhawk in half, debris from both ships cascading outward as lightning coruscates between the two obliterated vessels. Agate's own ship is right in the middle of it all. He hurriedly opens the channel. Everything focuses to a sharp point. Agate hears Akbar in her ear, is faintly aware of his presence cast in holographic blue to her right. He's warning her about the debris field coming her way, but he doesn't need to tell her about it. She sees it on her screens. 100 red motes blink like furious eyes winking in the dark. Each is a piece of debris, and each piece rockets toward her like a weapon. The wreckage of not one ship, but two. That wave of destruction will be here in less than 3 minutes. She yells for Spawn to strengthen the port side shields, but she knows they'll only hold up so long. That many fragments? It's too much.
Abandon ship, Commodore!
Akbar roars.
That is an order!
Yes, sir, she says, her voice sounding 1,000 light years away. This is what it's come down to, she thinks. Her return to war is over as quickly as it began. Their brute force strategy to break the blockade of Star Destroyers has ended. The Amity is down. The Concorde won't last. She barks for the communications officer to warn the Unity they have room to maneuver, to get out of range. Not only will the Concorde create its own debris field, but with that Star Destroyer gone and the two Starhawks vacating the field, that will leave the Unity vulnerable to attacks from that massive dreadnought waiting in the center of it all. Abandon ship. She makes the call. It's the right thing to do, and they're going to have to move fast. Worst thing is, they can only use the pods on the starboard side. Otherwise, they'd launch right into the wave of wreckage. Red lights pulse. Klaxons blare. A flurry of activity rises around her as the people of the bridge do as they have been trained to do, streaming efficiently and effectively toward the exits. The Capital Command crew have escape pods all their own and within spitting distance of the bridge. Her artificial eye focuses on the screens. She sweeps her finger ahead, fast-forwarding the expected consequences of what's coming. The computer is predictive and models the likeliest outcome. The debris will damage, but not destroy, the Concorde. It will, however, leave them open to attack from the dreadnought. And they're close enough to the top of Jakku's atmosphere that the ship will likely drop toward the surface, crashing into sand and stone. They will lose the Concorde one way or another. Spawn grabs her elbow.
Commodore, it's time.
I'm coming, she says. I'll be right there. But it's a lie.
Commodore?
I said go. I'll be along. Akbar starts to ask her what she's doing. She ends communication with him. I'm sorry, Admiral. But she realizes something. If the destruction of the Punishment and the Amity open up her ship to attack by the Dreadnought, then it also opens up the Dreadnought to attack by the Concorde. She has her chance. It's one she likely cannot survive. But the costs of war are heavy, even in victory. That has been one of her guiding, governing principles. It is a grudging reality that informs all that she does in battle. Her hand is no longer trembling. It has been stayed, perhaps by the first moment of certainty she's felt in a very long time. How about that? She uses her newly steady hand to urge forward the Concorde's throttle so that it seizes the gap in the Star Destroyer barricade, thrusting hard toward the dreadnought. Above her head, lights flick from red to green, pod bays launching one after the other as her people abandon ship.
Good. Go. Get safe.
She takes a moment to look around her. She's alone,
like a little island in the center of a calm, quiet lake. Her screens light up. As expected, the dreadnought is unleashing hell. Right as debris from the two eradicated ships begins slamming into the Concorde. Lights go dark, then bright, then dark again. The ship shakes and bangs, as if it's a toy held in the hand of a careless child. From Augate's bridge console, she flicks over to the weapons consoles. She prepares everything they have, every bit of ordnance this ship has to bear.
Bring hell to my door? I'll bring it to yours.
She fires everything. Banks of turbo lasers, ion torpedoes, concussion missiles. Bright lines of death streaking through the black. Lines of the same fire, castigation, heat, launching from the Ravager toward her. Like threads of light seeking each other. But they will pass each other instead. Each heading onward to an act of destruction, not creation. The Concorde roars toward it, even as its deflector shields begin to fail on the side. The ship tilts starboard. Debris punches through the hull. The engines gutter. She wills the ship to keep going. Hope is a fire fast extinguished inside her. She sees the fury unleashed from the dreadnought. Predictive analysis shows the Concorde losing this fight. Her volley cannot match that from the Ravager. The Ravager is a beast and will not be sated. She will damage it, to what extent she cannot say. But if she opens it up to attack, even still, her mind attempts the calculations. If she opens up a hole in the side of that thing, it's something, but it's still not enough. And if the other Star Destroyers close the gap and protect the injury made against the Ravager, then what? Out there, through the cathedral-like arches of glass, she sees the weapon streaming toward her.
This is it.
But then, Augate has a new idea. War brings with it moments of inevitability. A sinking ship. An onrushing horde. A mortal wound. The worst kind, Akbar thinks, are the moments when you watch friends die. Especially those times when it happens slowly. Too slowly. As if all the moments leading up to it are drawn out and given time like images flash-pulsed into your mind's eye. This is one of those times. Augate cuts communication with him, and he sees the Concorde burn hard and move toward the dreadnought as both it and the monstrous Ravager launch everything at each other. The problem is, the Ravager's weapons are far greater than those of a single Starhawk. The Starhawk's weapons are prodigious and better than even he has on the Home One. It is the uttermost of their tech. Bleeding-edge armament. But by itself, it can only hope to wound the Dreadnought. And it will die in service of that act. Augate is still on board. He knows this. She is going down with her ship. A dramatic gesture that he hopes has purpose behind it. He suspects she feels that she must command every moment between now and her end. That it should be her hand directing the ship and its fusillade of fire. But the Starhawk makes an unexpected turn. The Concorde banks sharply to the starboard, maneuvering quickly to turn that side of itself toward the incoming attack. The port is already damaged by the debris field. The starboard side taking the hit, with the shields already gone, Akbar sees, may not destroy the Starhawk outright, but it'll sink it. Already its engines are damaged on the far side. Atmosphere will grab that vessel like mud sucking on a soldier's boot. A hologram flashes over his console. It's Augate.
Augate, get off that ship!
Admiral, listen. Get everyone you can to hit that dreadnought from aft. Take out its engines. Send every starfighter, every CR-90, anyone.
Commodore, I command you to abandon that vessel!
Admiral, it literally pains me to deny your order. But please, trust me. Listen to me. The engines!
Out the viewport and on his screen, He watches the fusillade from the Ravager close in on the Concorde.
What are you doing? Hitting those engines? The Ravager is not moving. The engines aren't where we need to be concentrating our fire.
Just trust me.
Commodore.
Thank you, Admiral. It has been the highest honor.
Kirsta!
And then she's gone again. Just trust me. War brings with it moments of inevitability, yes. But it also carries with it the opposite. Moments of grave uncertainty, bridged only by acts of blind faith. When they say to one another, "May the Force be with you," it is precisely this that they mean. It is a wish that when the time comes to leap into the void and to make a decision based on instinct and trust, you are rewarded for that act and not punished. The hope is that if you meet the galaxy halfway, it meets you in the middle and carries you the rest of the distance. Akbar decides to trust and to leap and to pray that the Force is with them all. The exchange of destruction is a mighty one. The Concorde's barrage slams into the Ravager, ripping a hole in the side of the gargantuan ship with the ferocity of a biting, rending rancor. The injury is black and deep, but not fatal. And the Dreadnought's own weapons strike the Concorde, slipping past what little is left of the deflector shields and punching clean through it. Oxygen whistles out into the void. Fire plumes as chemicals off-gas into space. The ship groans. Somewhere in the belly of the ship, explosions start going off. Fuel cells and magna batteries chain-reacting. Boom, boom, boom! It won't detonate the whole ship, but it has gutted it. The ship is dead in the water. And without the repulsors from underneath keeping it aloft, the atmosphere of Jakku is like a reaching, claiming hand. She feels the ship drift downward, drifting as it goes. But the Starhawks were designed with one thing in mind: upgrade. So long did the Rebels endure an aging piecemeal fleet that when the time came to finally design something new to serve the nascent Republic, they went all in. Every internal system, every external design feature, every weapon, all of it was upgraded beyond the watermark set by the Mon Cala ships prior, and beyond the known capabilities of the Empire's extant ships. One of the features that saw the largest boost in ability? The tractor beam. The role of the tractor beam is simple: to grab an object in space, usually a spacecraft, in order to usher it safely into a docking bay, or to seize the vessel and pull it closer. The tractor beams on a Star Destroyer were notoriously vicious, with the strength to draw a Corellian corvette into its bay, or to stop a Nebulon frigate from making the escape to lightspeed. The tractor beam on the Starhawk is 10 times that. Magnite crystals amplify both the range and the strength of the beam. A Starhawk could capture and move a ship many times its own size. Augate dials up the tractor beam, points it at the Ravager. She fires.
"If I'm going down to the ground," she thinks, "you're coming with me."
Grand Moff Rand sits in a chair on the bridge of the Ravager. Up until now, he has felt supremely in control of this battle. The Ravager is a vessel whose might is presently unparalleled in the Imperial fleet, and to have been given command of it by Rax himself is an honor he will not squander. His forces have stopped the rebel-born false Republic fleet at every turn. Though he is no true tactician, he has many great minds working for him, and their plan of forming a perimeter of vessels around the Dreadnought was a sound one. Until now. The three ships pressing at the barrier, Starhawks, he believes they are called, manufactured for the false Republic, were held fast at the margins, even though the Star Destroyers were taking heavy fire as a result. And then something happened with the punishment. The officer in charge of that ship, Captain Groff, appeared in a panic. He said that the destroyer was suffering a coolant leak from the shield generators that was cascading through the upper levels. Some areas were experiencing fires. He seemed positively deranged. That was a factor Rand had long been worried about. Coming to this desolate world, this far-flung system, brought with it the chance to wear on a man's soul. It could erode a weaker mind. When he explained that fear to Counselor Rax, the man said, "Do not worry about that. The Imperials that have come to Jakku are the greatest of our kind. We will not break. The unkindness of this world will only bolster us. We will harden like calluses, Rand." And that was the end of that. In Rax they trusted. Rand still trusts him. They have survived this long, and there's no doubt that Rax is admirable, capable, a true hero of the Empire. Rand is a fan of belt-tightening, and using Jakku to harden their hearts against the fight to come was, to his mind, genius. But now, what he feared most has come true. Groff lost it. He said that he would not abandon his ship. The New Republic would torture him and execute him. His own people would turn on him. He was frothing with distemper, screaming suddenly about how the New Republic were traitors, and they all deserved death like dogs, and how they must give no quarter, no quarter at all. The last thing he said was,
"I must be a stronger blade! A blade with which to slit the throats of the traitors that crawl on their bellies toward our door!"
Rand recognized it as a line from Counselor Rax's speech. Groff's comms went dark after that, and then he crashed the punishment into the nearest Starhawk. That led to a chain of events even now Rand does not completely understand. Debris from the two ships hit a second Starhawk, and that one he felt sure would be out of the picture. But no. That ship accelerated in the gap right toward the Ravager, firing all its weapons. And so Rand demanded they return fire all the way, reserving every weapon system they had, launching ordnance in the direction of the onrushing Starhawk, a ship that now identifies itself as the Concorde. The Concorde turned broadside and took the hits just as the Ravager took its own. That ship was scuttled. He did not need his systems to confirm it. His eyes told him all he needed to know. Meanwhile, the Ravager was fine. Damaged, yes, and now more vulnerable. But he rerouted power to the deflectors to magnify protection over that chasm, and then, the strangest thing. The Concorde snared the dreadnought with a tractor beam. Rand is not a man given to humor. His wife, Danasik, says that she believes he laughs once, perhaps twice a year. But here, he almost laughed. Why in all of space and time would the captain of that Starhawk see fit to lash him with a paltry tractor beam? Perhaps to save herself the fall into atmosphere? The Ravager serving as an anchor? He hates to tell her, but gravity is a cruel mistress. It takes what it wants and will not be denied. The Ravager moves suddenly. Moves, but he does not command it to move.
"Status report!"
he barks, his calm voice suffering a sudden break to it, like that of a boy just getting hair on his chest.
"Status report!"
Nearby, Vice Admiral Pearson appears, sweat beating on his brow.
"The Starhawk has affixed us with its tractor beam."
"Yes, I know that. How are we..."
The ship drifts again.
"How is it moving us?"
I have no idea. It must be powerful.
Strengthen our engines. Reverse course. Fire repulsors.
Alarms go off. The ship shakes again. This time the sensation is different. Like something is hitting it. Pearson's eyes go wide.
They're concentrating fire on our aft.
The screens show a sudden flurry of starfighters. Every variety brought to bear against their engines. If they lose those...
"Engine 5 just went dark!"
an ensign yells.
"Now sub-engines 3 through 6!
An engineering officer cries.
"The Concorde is trying to track us down to Jakku." The nerve.
Fire all weapons at that Starhawk!
Sir,
Pearson responds.
The weapon systems will cycle in 2 minutes. We already hit them with everything we had. On your orders.
Then send TIEs after it!
But they're protecting our flank! The engines!
Again, the ship shakes. Worse this time. And when it does, it's like trying to move something heavy and failing until it suddenly gives way. The Ravager slides and dips downward so hard, Rand's jaw snaps tight, teeth closing hard on his tongue. He tastes blood and curses.
The atmosphere,
Pearson says.
We're entering Atmo, sir.
Bolster the engines! Bolster the repulsors! Bolster everything!
But in his head, Rand knows the score. It is too late. The Ravager is done for. He has squandered his chance, and now hope is lost. The greatest weapon in the Empire's arsenal is lost because of him. A flagging fear nags him.
It should be Ray Sloan in this chair, not me.
The one thing about Rand is that he is not a sycophant. He is no zealot. He admires Rax. He trusted him. But he will not be crucified for this. In the chaos of the moment, the flickering lights, the shaking ship, the flurry of movement going on across the bridge, Rand sneaks quietly away, boards an escape pod, and jettisons himself into space. The Concorde has leashed the larger ship with its powerful tractor beam, and it draws it down toward atmosphere. New Republic starfighters hit the engines of the Ravager, one after the other, again and again. A returning loop of fire, while a pair of CR-90s keep the TIEs off their backs. The Unity, the last remaining Starhawk, has pulled back to a safe distance and is using its considerable weapons load to provide the Concorde with cover, peppering the nearby Star Destroyers with as much fire as it can muster. And then the Starhawk dips considerably as the atmosphere kisses it, the underside of the ship glowing with the sudden heat of re-entry. Blade Squadron reports that the last of the Ravager's main engines are out. Only the sub-engines remain, and they won't save it. The Dreadnought's front end is the first to follow the Starhawk, carving a line across the top of the sky where the black goes to blue, like a fading bruise. An aura of fire begins to glow around the Ravager's four. Akbar watches the two Titans fall. The Concorde goes first. Algate likely remains on board. She won't answer his comms, but a scan of the Starhawk shows that not a single pod remains undamaged, and the fighter bays are empty or destroyed. She has no way off that ship, and it is too late and too risky for a rescue. As the Starhawk drops, it drags the Ravager with it. Like a rider pulling its beast mount toward the edge of a waterfall. Closer, closer. Until both plunge through space and into sky. Until the gravity throttles each and draws them ineluctably downward. Akbar grabs the comm and warns those below.
Soldiers and pilots of the New Republic! The Dreadnought Ravager is down. It falls to Jakku. Beware debris and take cover!
All around him are the cheers of those on the bridge of the Home One as they watch the titanic vessel go faster and faster toward Jakku. But Akbar does not cheer. He nods quietly and mutters a small entreaty to the Force, asking it to protect those down below, underneath these falling giants. And further, to accept Kirsta Augate as one of its own.
I'm really getting the hang of this.
On Akiva, they have these bugs that fly over still water. Polywings, they're called. And they flit over the surface, changing course like the snap of one's fingers. They move this way and that, snagging smaller flies out of the air and eating them on the go. Chomp. Temin wants to be like those polywings. That's how he sees his X-Wing. He pivots the starfighter fast as lightning, moving erratically so that the TIEs don't see him coming. His heart is going so fast in his chest, he fears it's going to punch its way out. His blood roars like a river in his ears. An effervescent thrill elevates him to almost giddy heights. He's buoyed, too, by knowing that his mother is still alive, and that Bones is protecting her.
This is a good day, he thinks. The New Republic is going to win this war. My mother is alive. My best friend is here. And I'm in an X-Wing. And I'm not dead.
He cackles like Coco with his radio mic on. Coco cackles right back as the two of them cross in front of the other, slaloming around each other, spitting lasers at escaping TIEs. One forms up on Wedge's tail, and Temmin bites his lip to repress the grin that threatens to split his old face.
Phantom Leader, you've got a bug on your back. Let me swat him for you.
Wedge brings the X-Wing low over a dry red ravine, past a squadron of New Republic soldiers taking cover there in the shadows afforded by the gully. The TIE whips through the space behind Phantom Leader's X-Wing, and Temmin thinks to come in at an odd angle. Otherwise, he risks accidentally hitting Wedge with laser fire. He swoops left, then turns the nose of his ship right again. The TIE lines up in his sights. But Temmin doesn't need screens. He fires, and the four cannons on his open foil wings throw spears of plasma. But they never find their target. Temmin cries out as a piece of black metal crashes down right in front of him, separating him from his oblique pursuit of the TIE. It crashes into the ground, sending up a cloud of red dust. Temmin peels the ship away from its destined course, turning the X-Wing sharply to avoid other debris.
Blast it! That looked like a piece from a starship.
A turbine by the look of it. His comms growl with Admiral Akbar's voice.
Soldiers and pilots of the New Republic, the Dreadnought Ravager is down. It falls to Jakku. Beware debris and take cover!
The Ravager? It's down? He whoops as his giddy feeling surges higher. With the Ravager gone, that'll open up a huge hole in the Imperial fleet. That big monster was everything the Empire had. If it's gone, that means the New Republic just won this battle. And maybe the whole war.
Now it's all just cleanup.
Wedge still has that bug on him. So Temmin flicks the X-Wing back to the right again, looking for Phantom Leader in his scopes. Ah, there he is, dead ahead, zipping over a flat plain where the sand looks like waves frozen in space and time. He spies Yara coming in from the other side, and he thinks,
okay, Yara, let's see who blasts this bogey first.
He lines up his shot. Something hits his ship hard. And next thing he knows, he's spinning like a corkscrew. His brain forces itself to catch up to his head as he spirals out of control. And past ropes of cackling electricity, he sees on his screens that the wings have been sheared off on the one side. They're gone!
I'm going down. I'm hit. Mom!
He pulls up on the stick and levels out just as the X-Wing belly flops into the dust, kissing the surface of Jakku and sending up a tidal spray of sand behind him. The ship slides along on its belly, grinding and hissing as it does. Temmin's head snaps hard left and right, cracking into the blast glass of the cockpit viewports, each time rocking his dome dizzy. The cockpit pops, and he paws at the edges of his seat, pulling himself out. Temmin rolls over the edge of the X-Wing, landing in the space where the wings should be. His shoulder hits stone. He turns over and dry heaves. When he finally looks up again, he sees what took him out. Two dunes away, pitting a pair of S-foils, is a fist of metal from what looks like a Starhawk.
A Starhawk? I thought the Ravager was hit.
And it all starts coming down. Meteors made of broken starships start plowing into the ground. each time they hit. Jakku coughs up another geyser of sand.
Temin cries out at the cacophony of sound.
The booming drum of the planet being struck. The susurrus of sand rising and falling back to itself. The distant explosions. His ears ring, and he clamps his hands over them.
Temin risks looking up to see if he can spot the rest of Phantom Squadron. But as he does, the light is blotted out.
Day turns to night in the matter of moments. It's the Ravager. The Imperial Colossus drifts in front of the light, eclipsing the sun.
Another ship precedes it. That's the Starhawk.
Fire comes off the New Republic ship, tornadoes of flame crackling from holes in its side.
He thinks, it's coming down right on top of me. There's nowhere to run, nowhere I can go to get safe.
But the panic subsides when he realizes his perspective is off. Yes, the ship is massive, but no, it's not coming down here. It'll hit dozens of clicks away. But what will it hit? Who will it destroy? Their own people are that way.
So is the enemy. That's the Imperial line. The fighting is going on right there.
Temin pulls up his wrist comm and starts babbling into it, telling everyone to go, to move, to get out of the way.
But the device suddenly fritzes out and spits sparks before going dead.
A sound comes out of him, a small, fearful moan. He's never seen anything like it before. He wonders if this is how his mother felt flying inside the Death Star, and then escaping, watching it detonate behind her.
The Ravager struggles to stay aloft. He can see, even in the half-dark of eclipsed day, how, underneath, its positioning thrusters fire intermittently, desperately working to keep it from pointing straight at the ground, but failing to stop its fall. It moves inescapably toward the ground, leaning hard to the side. The Starhawk hits first. Temin runs up to the nearest dune and watches as the New Republic capital ship crashes into the sand, crumpling up as if some giant just stepped on it. He sees an AT-AT walker moving away from the impact site as fast as it can, which from here looks dreadfully, painfully slow. And it won't matter anyway. With the Starhawk gone, the tractor beam shears, and the Ravager's thrusters must cause it to overcompensate. It begins to invert, turning belly up as it drops. The Ravager hits next. It hits broadly, not spearing the ground, but crashing flat against it, upside down. The AT-AT never has a chance. Nor do the starfighters trapped in the shadow of the dreadnought before it crashes. Nobody does. It's like watching the ceiling fall down on a child's playroom of toys. The Ravager plows into the sand, and the impact rocks the whole world. The vibration moves outward in a monstrous ripple, sending sand up along the shockwave, and when it hits where Temin is standing, it knocks him off his feet. Again, his ears ring. Everything vibrates. His teeth, his toes, all his bones. He struggles to stand anew. And already, he can't see the Ravager anymore. A dust cloud of titanic proportions has been thrown into the sky. An anvil of black smoke goes up. Rolling outward is a cloud of dark dust. It's coming this way. The blood-red dust cloud bulges and roils, tumbling forward like a wave of death and despair. Temin scrambles back to his downed X-Wing, sliding into the cockpit and slamming it shut just as the dust and the sand wash over him. It brings the white sound of 1,000 angry whispers all around him, against the glass, against his ship. And it goes on for what seems like forever. Move over, Nora barks. Let me fly it.
I know how to fly,
Sloane snarls from the pilot's seat, her fingers gone bloodless from holding the shuttle's flight stick.
She weaves the ship in and out of a rain of falling debris as each piece plunges to the ground like a comet. I'm a damn good pilot. I got away from you, remember? Nora remembers. She grits her teeth and holds onto a handle above her head as Sloane whips the craft through the raining debris. Brenton sits in the co-pilot's seat, his face gone white, his eyes closed. He never was much of a flyer. Part of her wants to comfort him. Another part wants to take the blaster and knock some sense into his head with the butt of it. Bone stands behind her, stabilized without holding on to anything. She's about to say something else. The day goes to night. Sloane's gaze drifts upward. She gasps. A ragged, despairing sound. No. My ship. Those three words transmit such grief. Nora can't help but feel drawn in by them. It's absurd, maybe, to be so enamored with and connected to a ship. But Nora understands it. She didn't have a long career in that Y-Wing, but in the short time that she did, she came to love it like Temin loves that droid. Nora's eyes drift away from the Ravager to what precedes it. It's one of the Starhawks. She can't tell which one, but fear eats at her like an acid. It's the Concorde, isn't it? Nora doesn't know Kirsta Augate very well, but the woman was kind to her when she didn't need to be. Her reputation was that she was hard, but had empathy. Not just for her own people, but for the enemy, too. Nora hopes she'll see Augate again. The Starhawk hits the surface of Jakku, and moments later, the Ravager follows. It drops hard. A concussive wave kicks up, rocks the ship. Nora has a distant, disconnected thought that she cannot dwell on for long, lest it destroy her. How many died? How many died on that ship? Or underneath it as it fell? That, coupled with the feeling of victory in her heart. The one that tells her the New Republic may just have finished this war. It is a crass dichotomy, that feeling. She's felt it before, and she'll feel it again. The triumphant heart warring with the grief born of war. Nora composes herself. Her fight isn't over. None of this is. Sloane seems to pull herself together, too. The ex-admiral sets her jaw and her flight course, pulling away from the direction of the Ravager. Dust cloud coming in, she warns. It's out there. A fast-moving storm spilling toward them. The cloud lights up in places with bilious lightning. Thunder tumbles. Sloane pulls the shuttle away from it, but still, it encompasses them. When it does, the shuttle rocks back and forth, hitting tides of air turbulence that nearly have Nora losing her footing. Through the dust storm, she sees black clouds rising up above as pillars of fire and lightning brighten the air. And then it's gone again, washing over them and thinning out. The air is still gauzy with particulate matter, but once more, the horizon can be seen. Bones suddenly stiffens. His antenna glows green, beeping.
Master Temin is near.
What? Where?
Hello! May I go?
Nora knows that him leaving makes her vulnerable. If her husband is still in thrall to the control chip and sides with Sloane against her, she's not sure she can survive. But if Temin really is near, and maybe in danger, then the choice is no choice at all. Go! Bones flees, his claw feet clanking as he opens the ramp in the belly of the shuttle. She watches him collapse downward, tucking his narrow beaked head to his chest and wrapping his many jointed arms around his knees before rolling out of the ship and down to Jakku. When the storm is past, Temin once again reopens the cockpit and emerges. Though the wave has dissipated, dust still hangs gauzy in the air, and he coughs and blinks it away as he drops to the ground and staggers through the sand. What passes next,
are a few moments of almost eerie silence. The world gone still in the aftermath of the impact.
Then, somewhere far away, an explosion goes off. From the Ravager's wreckage, no less. Above the dreadnought, black specters of smoke rise, and those dark clouds pulse with a flickering fire glow. A stink of burning metal and spent fuel stings his nose. After that, the sounds of war return. Blaster shrieks and fighter engines roaring overhead. Concussive pulses and grenade detonations. Soldiers screaming. The silence is over. Again, he coughs, wincing. In the distance, he spies a contingent of New Republic commandos dug in behind the sand furrow kicked up by a wrecked transport. Troopers advance on them. Temin thinks, I should do something. I should help. From close by come the pneumatic piston sound and pounding footsteps of something all too familiar. An AT-ST walker. He sees its brutal cockpit crest the nearest dune. The cannons tracking in his direction. Temin knows he can't take that thing down, so he draws his blaster and runs in the other direction, feet carrying him over one dune and down the other, even as the thing's cannons surely track his movement. And then, he's running full throttle into a trio of desert troopers, their armor scarred, the grooves and joints caked with dust. They raise their blasters, and he skids to a halt, holding his in the air. The troopers don't say anything at first. Already that makes his hackles rise. Imperial soldiers are about protocol. They have a pattern. They warn you, tell you to drop it, like they're on a program. But this time, they follow no protocol. They remain silent. Behind him, the AT-ST tromps up the dune toward them. Its shadow falls across Temin. A shadow so damning, it's as if it has its own weight. Temin swallows hard, feeling sweat run down his jaw, his neck, his collarbone.
Shut your mouth,
the middle trooper says. That one's helmet has a hard dent in the plastoid surface. He's got a pauldron over the right shoulder, red and dark as a hot coal. He's the leader.
Rebel scum. Let's have some fun with this one,
says the trooper on the right, the face of the helmet painted with finger streaks of gray ash. The one on the left takes off his helmet. A jowly, scruff-cheeked man's face is underneath, lit up with rage. He points the blaster.
We shoot bits off him, one by one. Hands, ears, each knee. See how long we keep him alive. Then the AT-ST can finish him off. Scatter his atoms.
The one in the pauldrons says,
we should do it quickly. Get back to the battle.
Battle's over, Ashstreak says. Might as well have fun.
Nobody's listening to the leader. Nobody's listening to anybody. I'm going to die.
Scruffcheek looks up.
Hey, what the...
Temin whirls around to see something land, crab-like, on top of the AT-ST's cockpit skull. That something lifts its head, feral and red, showing off a set of hand-cut saw teeth.
Bones!
The troopers open fire, but Bones is fast, too fast for them. The droid grabs the rail at the edge of the AT-ST, swinging down like a monkey lizard, before flinging himself to the sand, landing in a crouch. Blaster fire riddles the space where he just was as he pivots, pirouettes, and begins handspringing across the sand. Plasma cooking the air as he dances around each lance of searing light. Arms snap back, blades stick out. Bones goes to work. He gets under the pauldroned leader, sticking a vibroblade up underneath the chin of the helmet with a dull crunch. The man's body twitches as his blaster drops. The modified B-1 droid whirls around the still-standing corpse like it's a pole, kicking out with one clawed foot and knocking Ashstreak back. As that trooper falls to the ground, Bones pounces on his chest and perforates the armor again and again with the blades. The man's heels kick the ground. Scruffcheek bellows for the AT-ST to fire. And fire it does. Loud blasts from its cannons biff through the sand, just missing Bones, but knocking the droid back, limbs akimbo. The scruffy trooper raises his own rifle to fire on Bones, and Temin launches himself at the man. His attack is clumsy and broadcast a kilometer away, but the helmetless stormtrooper isn't paying attention. Temin clubs the soldier in the temple with his own blaster, and the man topples like a tree. Bones is up again, cartwheeling away from the AT-ST's cannons. It tracks him, but its head is too slow, and the droid too fast. Temin's mechanical bodyguard returns to the place it landed, scurrying up the side of the walker's leg, metal clicking on metal, until it reaches the top once more. The droid struggles, his servos grinding, and his pneumos whining as he wrenches the top off the AT-ST, flinging the hatch behind him. Feet first, Bones silently slips into the cockpit of the chicken walker. Thus commences a bang and a rattle. The walker rocks back and forth, just slightly. It takes 10 seconds, no more, before Bones pops back out, wearing one of the driver's open-face helmets. A pair of black lens goggles hanging off in front of the B1's own ocular lenses.
Hello, Master Temin.
Temin falls to his knees, relieved.
Bones, I missed you, buddy.
I missed you. I performed by
Suddenly, the top of the walker erupts in fire and shrapnel, exploding. Temin is knocked backward. The breath knocked from his lungs in a thunderclap of air. He waves smoke out of his face and wipes the sand from his eyes, and when it clears, he sees the walker standing there. It's just two legs now. The cockpit is peeled back like a blooming metal flower, its durasteel petals burned and charred. Bones is nowhere to be found.
Bones? No! Bones! No!
He cries out, wondering what happened. Did it detonate all on its own? Was there something the droid did to cause it to explode? But then, a pair of A-wings appear overhead, roaring past. It was them. They shot the walker, and Bones along with it. Temin crawls on his hands and knees, looking for parts of his droid. He finds seared, melted limbs. He finds rivets and scrap. But he sees nothing else. No skull. No program motherboard. He draws sand into his hands, but it slips through his fingers with nothing to show for it. Bones saved his life, and now is gone. His best friend is slag. Temin presses his forehead to the hot sand and weeps.